enough reason to return a piece to the shop. We can't afford to show any crude or unfinished work. One unnoticed black speck on a silver necklace, and we're finished. On their list, Robert Childen's store appeared first. But only Ed could go there. Childen would certainly remember Frank Frank.
You got to do most of the actual selling, Ed said.
But he was resigned to approaching Childen himself. He had bought a good suit, new tie, white shirt, to make the right impression. Nonetheless, he looked ill at ease.
I know we're good, he said for the millionth time. But, hell.
Most of the pieces were abstract. Whirls of wire, loops, designs which to some extent the molten metals had taken on their own. Some had a spiderweb delicacy, an airiness. Others had a massive, powerful, almost barbaric heaviness. There was an amazing range of shape, considering how few pieces lay on the velvet trays.
And yet one store, Frank realized, could buy everything we have laid out here. We'll see each store once, if we fail. But if we succeed, if we get them to carry our line, we'll be going back to refill orders the rest of our lives.
Together, the two of them loaded the velvet board trays into the wicker basket.
We could get back something on the metal, Frank said to himself, if worse comes to worst. And the tools and equipment, we can dispose of them at a loss. But at least we'll get something. This is the moment to consult the Oracle. Ask, how will Ed make out on this first selling trip?
But he was too nervous to. It might give a bad omen, and he did not feel capable of facing it. In any case, the die was cast. The pieces were made. The shop set up. Whatever the I Ching might blab out at this point.
It can't sell our jewelry for us. It can't give us luck. I'll tackle Children's place first, Ed said. We might as well get it over with, and then you can try a couple. You're coming along, aren't you? In the truck? I'll park around the corner.
As they got into their pickup truck with their wicker hamper, Frank thought, God knows how good a salesman Ed is, or I am. Children can be sold, but it's going to take a presentation, like they say.
If Juliana were here, he thought,
she could stroll in there and do it without batting an eye. She's pretty. She can talk to anybody on earth. And she's a woman. After all, this is women's jewelry. She could wear it into the store.
Shutting his eyes, he tried to imagine how she would look with one of their bracelets on, or one of their large silver necklaces, with her black hair and her pale skin, doleful, probing eyes. Wearing a gray jersey sweater, a little bit too tight. The silver resting against her bare flesh, metal rising and falling as she breathed. God, she was vivid in his mind right now. Every piece they made, the strong, thin fingers picked up, examined. Tossing her head back, holding the piece high. Juliana sorting, always a witness to what he had done.
Best for her, he decided, would be earrings. The bright dangly ones, especially the brass, with her hair held back by a clip or cut short so that her neck and ears could be seen. And we could take photos of her for advertising and display.
He and Ed had discussed a catalog so they could sell by mail to stores in other parts of the world.
She would look terrific. Her skin is nice, very healthy. No sagging or wrinkles, and a fine color. Would she do it, if I could locate her?
No matter what she thinks of me, nothing to do with our personal life.
This would be a strictly business matter. Hell, I wouldn't even take the pictures. We'd get a professional photographer to do it.
That would please her. Her vanity probably is great as always. She always liked people to look at her, admire her.
Anybody.
I guess most women are like that. They crave attention all the time. They're very babyish that way.
He thought,
Juliana could never stand being alone. She had to have me around all the time complimenting her. Little kids are that way. They feel if their parents aren't watching what they do, then what they do isn't real. No doubt she's got some guy noticing her right now, telling her how pretty she is, her legs, her smooth, flat stomach.
"What's the matter?"
Ed said, glancing at him.
"Losing your nerve?"
"No," Frank said.
"I'm not just going to stand there," Ed said. "I've got a few ideas of my own. And I'll tell you something else. I'm not scared. I'm not intimidated just because it's a fancy place and I have to put on this fancy suit. I admit I don't like to dress up. I admit I'm not comfortable. But that doesn't matter a bit. I'm still going in there and really give it to that poophead."
Good for you, Frank thought.
"Hell, if you could go in there like you did," Ed said, "and give him that line about being a Jap Admiral's gentleman, I ought to be able to tell him the truth, that this is really good, creative, original, handmade jewelry, that..."
"Hand-wrought," Frank said.
"Yeah, hand-wrought. I mean, I'll go in there and I won't come back out until I've given him a run for his money. He ought to buy this. If he doesn't, he's really nuts. I've looked around. There isn't anything like ours for sale anywhere. God, when I think of him maybe looking at it and not buying it, it makes me so goddamn mad I could start swinging."
"Make sure you tell him it's not plated," Frank said. "That copper means solid copper, and brass, solid brass."
"You let me work out my own approach," Ed said. "I got some really good ideas."
Frank thought, "What I can do is this. I can take a couple of pieces, Ed'll never care, and box them up and send them to Juliana. So she'll see what I'm doing. The postal authorities will trace her. I'll send it registered to her last known address. What'll she say when she opens the box? There'll have to be a note from me explaining that I made it myself, that I'm a partner in a little new creative jewelry business. I'll fire her imagination. Give her an account that'll make her want to know more. That'll get her interested. I'll talk about the gems and the metals. The places we're selling to. The fancy stores."
"Isn't it along here?"
Ed said, slowing the truck. They were in heavy downtown traffic. Buildings blotted out the sky.
"I better park."
"Another 5 blocks," Frank said.
"Got one of those marijuana cigarettes?"
Ed said.
"One would calm me right about now."
Frank passed him his package of TN Lies, the heavenly music brand he had learned to smoke at WM Corporation. "I know she's living with some guy," Frank said to himself. "Sleeping with him. As if she was his wife. I know, Juliana. She couldn't survive any other way. I know how she gets around nightfall. When it gets cold and dark and everybody's home sitting around the living room. She was never made for a solitary life." "Me neither," he realized. "Maybe the guy's a real nice guy. Some shy student she picked up. She'd be a good woman for some young guy who had never had the courage to approach a woman before. She's not hard or cynical. It would do him a lot of good. I hope to hell she's not with some older guy. That's what I couldn't stand. Some experienced, mean guy with a toothpick sticking out of the side of his mouth, pushing her around." He felt himself begin to breathe heavily. Image of some beefy, hairy guy stepping down hard on Juliana, making her life miserable. "I know she'd finally wind up killing herself," he thought. "It's in the cards for her, if she doesn't find the right man, and that means a really gentle, sensitive, kindly student type who would be able to appreciate all those thoughts she has." "I was too rough for her," he thought. "And I'm not so bad. There are a hell of a lot of guys worse than me. I could pretty well figure out what she was thinking, what she wanted, when she felt lonely or bad or depressed. I spent a lot of time worrying and fussing over her. But it wasn't enough. She deserved more. She deserves a lot," he thought.
"I'm parking," Ed said.
He had found the place and was backing the truck, peering over his shoulder. "Listen," Frank said. "Can I send a couple of pieces to my wife?"
"I didn't know you were married."
Intent on parking, Ed answered him reflexively.
Sure, as long as they're not silver.
Ed shut off the truck motor.
We're here, he said.
He puffed marijuana smoke, then stubbed the cigarette out on the dashboard, dropped the remains to the cab floor.
Wish me luck.
Luck? Frank said.
Hey, look, there's one of those Jap Waka poems on the back of the cigarette package.
Ed read the poem aloud, over the traffic noises.
Hearing a cuckoo cry, I looked up in the direction whence the sound came. What did I see? Only the pale moon in the dawning sky.
He handed the package of TN lies back to Frank.
Christ, he said,
then slapped Frank on the back, grinned, opened the truck door, picked up the wicker hamper, and stepped from the truck.
I'll let you put the dime in the meter, he said, starting off down the sidewalk.
In an instant, he had disappeared among the other pedestrians.
Juliana, Frank thought. Are you as alone as I am?
He got out of the truck and put a dime in the parking meter.
Fear, he thought. This whole jewelry venture. What if it should fail? What if it should fail? That was how the oracle put it. Wailing, tears, beating the pot. Man faces the darkening shadows of his life, his passage to the grave. If she were here, it would not be so bad. Not bad at all. I'm scared, he realized. Suppose Ed doesn't sell a thing. Suppose they laugh at us. What then?
On a sheet on the floor of the front room of her apartment, Juliana lay holding Joe Cinadella against her. The room was warm and stuffy with mid-afternoon sunlight. Her body and the body of the man in her arms were damp with perspiration. A drop, rolling down Joe's forehead, clung a moment to his cheekbone, then fell to her throat.
You're still dripping, she murmured.
He said nothing. His breathing, long, slow, regular.
Like the ocean, she thought. We're nothing but water inside. How was it? She asked.
He mumbled that it had been okay.
I thought so, Juliana thought. I can tell. Now we both have to get up, pull ourselves together. Or is that bad? Sign of subconscious disapproval?
He stirred.
Are you getting up?
She gripped him tight with both her arms.
Don't! Not yet.
Don't you have to get to the gym?
I'm not going to the gym, Juliana said to herself. Don't you know that? We will go somewhere. We won't stay here too much longer, but it will be a place we haven't been before. It's time.
She felt him start to draw himself backward and up onto his knees, felt her hands slide along his damp, slippery back. Then she could hear him walking away, his bare feet against the floor. To the bathroom, no doubt, for his shower.
It's over, she thought.
Oh, well,
she sighed.
I hear you, Joe said from the bathroom. Groaning. Always downcast, aren't you? Worry, fear, and suspicion about me and everything else in the world.
He emerged briefly, dripping with soapy water, face beaming.
How would you like to take a trip?
Her pulse quickened.
Where? To some big city. How about north, to Denver? I'll take you out. Buy you ticket to a show. Good restaurant. Taxi. Get you evening dress or what you need. Okay?
She could hardly believe him. But she wanted to. She tried to.
Will that stud of yours make it?
Joe called.
Sure,
she said.
We'll both get some nice clothes, he said. Enjoy ourselves. Maybe for the first time in our lives. Keep you from cracking up.
Where'll we get the money?
Joe said,
I have it. Look in my suitcase.
He shut the bathroom door. The racket of water shut out any further words. Opening the dresser, she got out his dented, stained little grip. Sure enough, In one corner she found an envelope. It contained Reichsbank bills, high value and good anywhere.
Then we can go, she realized. Maybe he's not just stringing me along. I just wish I could get inside him and see what's there,
she thought as she counted the money. Beneath the envelope, she found a huge, cylindrical fountain pen, or at least it appeared to be that. It had a clip, anyhow, but it weighed so much. Gingerly, she lifted it out, unscrewed the cap. Yes, it had a gold point, but...
What is this?
She asked Joe when he reappeared from the shower. He took it from her, returned it to the grip.
How carefully he handled it.
She noticed that, reflected on it, perplexed.
More morbidity? Joe said.
He seemed light-hearted, more so than at any time since she had met him. With a yell of enthusiasm, he clasped her around the waist, then hoisted her up into his arms, rocking her, swinging her back and forth, peering down into her face, breathing his warm breath over her, squeezing her until she bleated.
No,
she said.
I'm just slow to change.
Still a little scared of you, she thought. So scared I can't even say it, tell you about it.
Out the window, Joe cried, stalking across the room with her in his arms. Here we go.
Please,
she said.
Kidding. Listen, we're going on a march, like they march on Rome. You remember that? The Duce led them, my Uncle Carlo, for example. Now we have a little march, less important, not noted in the history books. Right?
Inclining his head, he kissed her on the mouth so hard that their teeth clashed.
How nice we both look in our new clothes. And you can explain to me exactly how to talk, deport myself, right? Teach me manners, right?
You talk okay, Juliana said. Better than me, even.
No. He became abruptly somber. I talk very bad. A real WAP accent. Didn't you notice it when you first met me in the cafe?
I guess so,
she said. It did not seem important to her.
Only a woman knows the social conventions, Joe said, carrying her back and dropping her to bounce frighteningly on the bed. Without a woman, we'd discuss racing cars and horses and tell dirty jokes. No civilization.
You're in a strange mood, Juliana thought. Restless and brooding, until you decide to move on. Then you become hopped up. Do you really want me? You can ditch me, leave me here. It's happened before.
I would ditch you, she thought, if I were going on.
Is that your pay?
She asked as he dressed.
You saved it up?
It was so much. Of course, there was a good deal of money in the East.
All the other truck drivers I've talked to never made so...
You say I'm a truck driver?
Joe broke in.
Listen, I rode that rig not to drive, but keep off hijackers. Look like a truck driver, snoozing in the cab.
Flopping in a chair in the corner of the room, he lay back, pretending sleep, his mouth open, body limp.
See?
At first, she did not see. And then she realized that in his hand was a knife, as thin as a kitchen potato skewer.
Good grief, she thought. Where had it come from? Out of his sleeve? Out of the air itself?
That's why the Volkswagen people hired me. Service record. We protected ourselves against Hazelden, those commandos. He led them.
The black eyes glinted. He grinned sideways at Juliana.
Guess who got the colonel, there at the end,
when we caught them on the Nile, him and four of his long-range desert group months after the Cairo campaign. They raided us for gasoline one night. I was on sentry duty. Hazelden sneaked up, rubbed with black all over his face and body, even his hands. They had no wire that time, only grenades and submachine guns, all too noisy. He tried to break my larynx. I got him. From the chair, Joe sprang up at her, laughing.
Let's pack. You tell them at the gym you're taking a few days off. Phone them.
His account simply did not convince her. Perhaps he had not been in North Africa at all, had not even fought in the war on the Axis side, had not even fought. What hijackers? She wondered.
No truck that she knew of had come through Canyon City from the East Coast with an armed professional ex-soldier as guard.
Maybe he had not even lived in the USA, had made everything up from the start.
A line to snare her, to get her interested, to appear romantic.
Maybe he's insane, she thought. Ironic. I may actually do what I've pretended many times to have done, use my judo in self-defense. To save my virginity? My life, she thought.
But more likely, he is just some poor, low-class, wop laboring slob with delusions of glory. He wants to go on a grand spree, spend all his money, live it up, and then go back to his monotonous existence. And he needs a girl to do it.
Okay, she said. I'll call the gym.
As she went toward the hall, she thought,
he'll buy me expensive clothes and then take me to some luxurious hotel. Every man yearns to have a really well-dressed woman before he dies, even if he has to buy her the clothes himself. This binge is probably Joe Cinadella's lifelong ambition. And he is shrewd. I'll bet he's right in his analysis of me. I have a neurotic fear of the masculine. Frank knew it, too. That's why he and I broke up. That's why I still feel this anxiety now, this mistrust.
When she returned from the payphone, she found Joe once more engrossed in the grasshopper, scowling as he read, unaware of everything else.
"Weren't you going to let me read that?" she asked.
"Maybe while I drive," Joe said, without looking up.
"You're going to drive? But it's my car."
He said nothing. He merely went on reading. At the cash register, Robert Childen looked up to see a lean, tall, dark-haired man entering the store. The man wore a slightly less than fashionable suit and carried a large wicker hamper. Salesman. Yet he did not have the cheerful smile. Instead, he had a grim, morose look on his leathery face.
More like a plumber or an electrician, Robert Childen thought.
When he had finished with his customer, Childen called to the man,
"Who do you represent?" "Ed Frank Jewelry," the man mumbled back.
He had set his hamper down on one of the counters.
"Never heard of them."
Childen sauntered over as the man unfastened the top of the hamper and with much wasted motion, opened it.
"Hand-wrought, each unique, each an original. Brass, copper, silver, even hot-forged black iron."
Childen glanced into the hamper. Metal on black velvet. Peculiar.
"No, thanks. You're not in my line. Well, this represents American artistry. Contemporary."
Shaking his head no, Childen walked back to the cash register. For a time, the man stood fooling with his velvet display boards and hamper. He was neither taking the boards out nor putting them back. He seemed to have no idea what he was doing. His arms folded, Childen watched, thinking about various problems of the day. At 2, he had an appointment to show some early period cups. Then at 3, another batch of items returning from the Cal Labs, home from their authenticity test. He had been having more and more pieces examined in the last couple of weeks, ever since the nasty incident with the Colt 44.
"Well, these are not plated,"
the man with the wicker hamper said, holding up a cuff bracelet.
"Solid copper."
Childen nodded without answering. The man would hang around for a while, shuffle his samples about, but finally he would move on. The telephone rang. Childen answered it. Customer inquiring about an ancient rocking chair, very valuable, which Childen was having mended for him. It had not been finished, and Childen had to tell a convincing story. Staring through the store window at the midday traffic, he soothed and reassured. At last, the customer, somewhat appeased, rang off.
"No doubt about it," he thought as he hung up the phone. The Colt 44 affair had shaken him considerably.
He no longer viewed his stock with the same reverence. A bit of knowledge like that goes a long way. Akin to primal childhood awakening. Facts of life. Shows, he ruminated, the link with our early years. Not merely U.S. history involved, but our own personal. As if, he thought, question might arise as to authenticity of our birth certificate, or our impression of Dad. Maybe I don't actually recall FDR, as example. Synthetic image distilled from hearing assorted talk. Myth implanted subtly in tissue of brain. Like, he thought, myth of Heppelwhite, myth of Chippendale, or rather more on lines of Abraham Lincoln ate here. Use this old silver knife, fork, spoon. You can't see it, but the fact remains. At the other counter, still fumbling with his displays and wicker hamper, the salesman said, "We can make pieces to order. Custom-made. If any of your customers have their own ideas." His voice had a strangled quality. He cleared his throat, gazing at Childen, and then down at a piece of jewelry which he held. He did not know how to leave, evidently. Childen smiled and said nothing. Not my responsibility. His, to get himself back out of here. Place saved or no. Tough, such discomfort. But he doesn't have to be salesman. We all suffer in this life. Look at me. Taking an all day from Japs such as Mr. Tagomi. By merest inflection, managed to rub my nose in it. Make my life miserable. And then an idea occurred to him. Fellow's obviously not experienced. Look at him. Maybe I can get some stuff on consignment. Worth a try. Hey, Childen said. The man glanced up swiftly, fastened his gaze. Advancing toward him, his arms still folded, Childen said, "Looks like a quiet half hour here. No promises, but you can lay some of those things out. Clear back those racks of ties," he pointed. Nodding, the man began to clear himself a space on the top of the counter. He reopened his hamper, once more fumbled with the velvet trays. "He'll lay everything out," Childen knew. "Arrange it painstakingly for the next hour. Fuss and adjust until he's got it all set up. Hoping, praying, watching me out of the corner of his eye every second, to see if I'm taking any interest. Any at all." "When you have it out," Childen said, "if I'm not too busy, I'll take a look." The man worked feverishly, as if he had been stung. Several customers entered the store then, and Childen greeted them. He turned his attention to them and their wishes, and forgot the salesman laboring over his display. The salesman, recognizing the situation, became stealthy in his movements. He made himself inconspicuous. Childen sold a shaving mug, almost sold a hand-hooked rug, took a deposit on an Afghan. Time passed. At last the customers left. Once more the store was empty except for himself and the salesman. The salesman had finished. His entire selection of jewelry lay arranged on the black velvet on the surface of the counter. Going leisurely over, Robert Childen lit a Lando Smiles and stood rocking back and forth on his heels, humming beneath his breath. The salesman stood silently. Neither spoke. At last Childen reached out and pointed at a pin. "I like that," the salesman said in a rapid voice. "That's a good one. You won't find any wire brush scratches. All rouge finished, and it won't tarnish. We have a plastic lacquer sprayed on them that'll last for years. It's the best industrial lacquer available." Childen nodded slightly. "What we've done here," the salesman said, "is to adapt tried and proven industrial techniques to jewelry making. As far as I know, nobody has ever done it before. No molds, all metal to metal, welding and brazing." He paused. "The backs are hand-soldered." Childen picked up two bracelets, then a pin, then another pin. He held them for a moment, then set them off to one side. The salesman's face twitched. Hope. Examining the price tag on a necklace, Childen said,
Is this? Retail. Your price is 50% of that. And if you buy, say, around $100 or so, we give you an additional 2%.
One by one, Childen laid several pieces aside. With each additional one, the salesman became more agitated. He talked faster and faster, finally repeating himself, even saying meaningless, foolish things, all in an undertone and very urgently.
He really thinks she's going to sell, Childen knew.
By his own expression, he showed nothing. He went on with the game of picking pieces.
That's an especially good one, the salesman was rambling on, as Childen fished out a large pendant and then ceased. I think you got our best. All our best.
The man laughed.
You really have good taste.
His eyes darted. He was adding in his mind what Childen had chosen, the total of the sale.
Childen said, Our policy, with untried merchandise, has to be consignment.
For a few seconds, the salesman did not understand. He stopped his talking, but he stared without comprehension. Childen smiled at him.
Consignment, the salesman echoed at last. Would you prefer not to leave it? Childen said.
Stammering, the man finally said,
You mean I leave it and you pay me later on when... You get two-thirds of the proceeds when the pieces sell. That way you make much more. You have to wait, of course. But,
Childen shrugged,
it's up to you. I can give it some window display, possibly. And if it moves, then possibly later on, in a month or so, with the next order, well, we might see our way clear to buy some outright.
The salesman had now spent well over an hour showing his wares, Childen realized. And he had everything out. All his displays disarranged and dismantled. Another hour's work to get it back ready to take somewhere else. There was silence. Neither man spoke.
Those pieces you put to one side, the salesman said in a low voice. They're the ones you want?
Yes. I'll let you leave them all.
Childen strolled over to his office in the rear of the store.
I'll write up a tag, so you'll have a record of what you've left with me.
As he came back with his tag book, he added,
You understand that when merchandise is left on a consignment basis, the store doesn't assume liability in case of theft or damage.
He had a little mimeographed release for the salesman to sign. The store would never have to account for the items left. When the unsold portion was returned, if some could not be located,
they must have been stolen, Childen declared to himself. There's always theft going on in stores, especially small items like jewelry.
There was no way that Robert Childen could lose. He did not have to pay for this man's jewelry. He had no investment in this kind of inventory. If any of it sold, he made a profit, and if it did not, he simply returned it all, or as much as could be found, to the salesman at some vague, later date. Childen made out the tag, listing the items. He signed it and gave a copy to the salesman.
You can give me a call, he said, in a month or so, to find out how it's been doing.
Taking the jewelry which he wanted, he went off to the back of the store, leaving the salesman to gather up his remaining stuff.
I didn't think he'd go along with it, he thought. You never know. That's why it's always worth trying.
When he next looked up, he saw that the salesman was ready to leave. He had his wicker hamper under his arm, and the counter was clear. The salesman was coming toward him, holding something out.
Yes?
Childen said. He had been going over some correspondence.
I want to leave our card.
The salesman put down an odd-looking little square of gray and red paper on Childen's desk.
Ed Frank Custom Jewelry. It has our address and phone number, in case you want to get in touch with us.
Childen nodded, smiled silently, and returned to his work. When next he paused and looked up, the store was empty. The salesman had gone. Putting a nickel into the wall dispenser, Childen obtained a cup of hot instant tea, which he sipped contemplatively.
I wonder if it will sell, he wondered. Very unlikely. but it is well made. And one never sees anything like it.
He examined one of the pins.
Quite striking design. Certainly not amateurs. I'll change the tags. Mark them up a lot higher. Push the handmade angle and the uniqueness. Custom originals. Small sculptures. Wear a work of art. Exclusive creation on your lapel or wrist.
And there was another notion circulating and growing in the back of Robert Childen's mind.
With these, there's no problem of authenticity. And that problem may someday wreck the historic American artifacts industry. Not today or tomorrow, but after that, who knows? Better not to have all irons in one fire. That visit by that Jewish crook, that might be the harbinger. If I quietly build up a stock of non-historic objects, contemporary work with no historicity either real or imagined, I might find I have the edge over the competition. And as long as it isn't costing me anything.
Leaning back his chair so that it rested against the wall, he sipped his tea and pondered.
The moment changes. One must be ready to change with it, or otherwise left high and dry. Adapt.
The rule of survival, he thought.
Keep eye peeled regarding situation around you. Learn its demands, and meet them. Be there at the right time, doing the right thing. Be Yinnish. The Oriental knows. The smart black Yinnish eyes.
Suddenly he had a good idea. It made him sit upright instantly.
Two birds, one stone. Ah!
He hopped to his feet, excited. Carefully wrap best of jewelry pieces, removing tag, of course. Pin, pendant, or bracelet. Something nice, anyhow. Then, since have to leave shop, close up at 2, as it is, saunter over to Kasura's apartment building. Mr. Kasura's, Paul, will be at work. However, Mrs. Kasura, Betty, will very likely be home. Graft gift, this new original U.S. artwork. Compliments of myself personally, in order to obtain high place reaction. This is how a new line is introduced. Isn't it lovely? Whole selection back at store. Drop in, etc. This one for you, Betty. He trembled. Just she and I. Midday in the apartment. Husband off at work. All on up and up, however. Brilliant pretext. Airtight. Getting a small box plus wrapping paper and ribbon, Robert Childen began preparing a gift for Mrs. Kasura.
Dark, attractive woman. Slender in her silk oriental dress. High heels and so on. Or maybe today, blue cotton coolie-style lounging pajamas. Very light and comfortable and informal. Ah, he thought. Or is this too bold? Husband Paul becoming irked, scenting out and reacting badly. Perhaps go slower. Take gift to him? To his office? Give much the same story, but to him. Then let him give gift to her. No suspicion. And, Robert Childen thought, then I give Betty a call on the phone tomorrow or next day to get her reaction. Even more airtight.
When Frank Frink saw his business partner coming back up the sidewalk, he could tell that it had not gone well.
What happened?
He said, taking the wicker hamper from Ed and putting it in the truck.
Jesus Christ, you were gone an hour and a half. It took him that long to say no?
Ed said,
he didn't say no.
He looked tired. He got into the truck and sat.
What did he say then?
Opening the hamper, Frink saw that a good many of the pieces were gone, many of their best.
He took a lot. What's the matter then?
Consignment, Ed said.
You let him?
He could not believe it.
We talked it over. I don't know how come.
Christ,
Frink said.
I'm sorry. He acted like he was going to buy it. He picked a lot out. I thought he was buying.
They sat together silently in the truck for a long time. 10. It had been a terrible 2 weeks for Mr. Baines. From his hotel room, he had called the trade mission every day at noon to ask if the old gentleman had put in an appearance. The answer had been an unvarying no. Mr. Tagomi's voice had become colder and more formal each day. As Mr. Baines prepared to make his 16th call, he thought, "Sooner or later they'll tell me that Mr. Tagomi is out, that he isn't accepting any more calls from me, and that will be that." What has happened? Where is Mr. Yatabi? He had a fairly good idea. The death of Martin Borman had caused immediate consternation in Tokyo. Mr. Yatabi, no doubt, had been en route to San Francisco, a day or so offshore, when new instructions had reached him. Return to the home islands for further consultation. Bad luck, Mr. Baines realized. Possibly even fatal. But he had to remain where he was, in San Francisco, still trying to arrange the meeting for which he had come. 45 minutes by Lufthansa rocket from Berlin, and now this. A weird time in which we are alive. We can travel anywhere we want, even to other planets. And for what? To sit day after day, declining in morale and hope, falling into an interminable ennui. And meanwhile, the others are busy. They are not sitting helplessly, waiting. Mr. Baines unfolded the midday edition of the Nippon Times and once more read the headlines. Dr. Goebbels named Reichschancellor. Surprise solution to leadership problem by Partei Committee. Radio speech viewed decisive. Berlin crowd cheer. Statement expected. Goering may be named police chief over Heydrich. He reread the entire article, and then he put the paper once more away, took the phone, and gave the trade mission number. "This is Mr. Baines. May I have Mr. Tagomi?"
"A moment, sir."
A very long moment.
"Mr. Tagomi here."
Mr. Baines took a deep breath and said,
"Forgive this situation, depressing to us both, sir." "Ah, Mr. Baines."
"Your hospitality to me, sir, could not be exceeded. Some day I know you will have understanding of the reasons which cause me to defer our conference until the old gentleman..."
"Regretfully, he has not arrived."
Mr. Baines shut his eyes.
"I thought maybe since yesterday..."
"Afraid not, sir."
The barest politeness.
"If you will excuse me, Mr. Baines. Pressing business."
"Good day, sir."
The phone clicked. Today, Mr. Tagomi had rung off without even saying goodbye. Mr. Baines slowly hung the receiver.
"I must take action. Can wait no longer."
It had been made very clear to him by his superiors that he was not to contact the Abwehr under any circumstances. He was simply to wait until he had managed to make connections with the Japanese military representative. He was to confer with the Japanese, and then he was to return to Berlin. But no one had foreseen that Bormann would die at this particular moment. Therefore, the orders had to be superseded by more practical advice. His own, in this case, since there was no one else to consult. In the PSA, at least 10 Abwehr persons were at work, but some of them, and possibly all, were known to the local SD and its competent senior regional chief, Bruno Kreutz von Mira. Years ago, he had met Bruno briefly at a Partei gathering. The man had had a certain infamous prestige in police circles, inasmuch as it had been he, in 1943, who had uncovered the British-Czech plot on Reinhard Heydrich's life, and therefore who might be said to have saved the hangman from assassination. In any case, Bruno Kreutz von Mira was already then ascending in authority within the SD. He was not a mere police bureaucrat. He was, in fact, a rather dangerous man. There was even a possibility that even with all the precautions taken, both on the part of the Abwehr in Berlin and the Tokoka in Tokyo,
The SD had learned of this attempted meeting in San Francisco in the offices of the ranking trade mission. However, this was, after all, Japanese-administered land. The SD had no official authority to interfere. It could see to it that the German principal, himself in this case, was arrested as soon as he set foot again on Reich territory. But it could hardly take action against the Japanese principal or against the existence of the meeting itself. At least, so he hoped. Was there any possibility that the SD had managed to detain the old Japanese gentleman somewhere along the route? It was a long way from Tokyo to San Francisco, especially for a person so elderly and frail that he could not attempt air travel. What I must do, Mr. Baines knew, is find out from those above me whether Mr. Yatabe is still coming. They would know. If the SD had intercepted him, or if the Tokyo government has recalled him, they would know that. And if they have managed to get to the old gentleman, he realized, they certainly are going to get to me. Yet the situation, even in those circumstances, was not hopeless. An idea had come to Mr. Baines as he waited day after day alone in his room at the Abharati Hotel. It would be better to give my information to Mr. Togomi than to return to Berlin empty-handed. At least that way there would be a chance, even if it is rather slight, that ultimately the proper people will be informed. But Mr. Togomi could only listen. That was the fault in his idea. At best, he could hear, commit to memory, and as soon as possible take a business trip back to the home islands. Whereas Mr. Yatabe stood at policy level, he could both hear and speak. Still, it was better than nothing. The time was growing too short. To begin all over, to arrange painstakingly, consciously, over a period of months once again, the delicate contact between a faction in Germany and a faction in Japan. It certainly would surprise Mr. Togomi, he thought acidly, to suddenly find knowledge of that kind resting on his shoulders, a long way from facts about injection molds. Possibly he might have a nervous breakdown, either blurt out the information to someone around him, or withdraw, pretend, even to himself, that he had not heard it, simply refuse to believe me, rise to his feet, bow, and excuse himself from the room the moment I begin. Indiscreet. He could regard it that way. He is not supposed to hear such matters. So easy, Mr. Baines thought. The way out is so immediate, so available to him, he thought. I wish it was for me. And yet, in the final analysis, it is not possible even for Mr. Togomi. We are no different. He can close his ears to the news as it comes from me, comes in the form of words. But later, when it is not a matter of words, if I can make that clear to him now, or to whomever I finally speak. Leaving his hotel room, Mr. Baines descended by elevator to the lobby. Outside, on the sidewalk, he had the doorman call a pedicab for him, and soon he was on his way up Market Street, the Chinese driver pumping away energetically. There, he said to the driver, when he made out the sign which he was watching for. Pull over to the curb. The pedicab stopped by a fire hydrant. Mr. Baines paid the driver and sent him off. No one seemed to have followed. Mr. Baines set off along the sidewalk on foot. A moment later, along with several other shoppers, he entered the big downtown Fuga department store. There were shoppers everywhere, counter after counter. Salesgirls, mostly white, with a sprinkling of Japanese as department managers. The din was terrific. After some confusion, Mr. Baines located the men's clothing department. He stopped at the racks of men's trousers and began to inspect them. Presently a clerk, a young white, came over, greeting him. Mr. Baines said, I have returned for the pair of dark brown wool slacks which I was looking at yesterday. Meeting the clerk's gaze, he said, You're not the man I spoke to. He was taller. Red mustache. Rather thin.
On his jacket he had the name Larry. The clerk said, "He is presently out to lunch, but will return. I'll go into a dressing room and try these on," Mr. Baines said, taking a pair of slacks from the rack.
"Certainly, sir."
The clerk indicated a vacant dressing room and then went off to wait on someone else. Mr. Baines entered the dressing room and shut the door. He seated himself on one of the two chairs and waited. After a few minutes, there was a knock. The door of the dressing room opened, and a short, middle-aged Japanese entered.
"You are from out of state, sir," he said to Mr. Baines. "And I am to okay your credit? Let me see your identification."
He shut the door behind him. Mr. Baines got out his wallet. The Japanese seated himself with the wallet and began inspecting the contents. He halted at a photo of a girl.
"Very pretty. My daughter, Martha." "I, too, have a daughter named Martha," the Japanese said. "She at present is in Chicago studying piano."
"My daughter," Mr. Baines said, "is about to be married."
The Japanese returned the wallet and waited expectantly. Mr. Baines said,
"I have been here 2 weeks and Mr. Yatabi has not shown up. I want to find out if he is still coming, and if not, what I should do."
"Return tomorrow afternoon,"
the Japanese said. He rose, and Mr. Baines also rose.
"Good day."
"Good day," Mr. Baines said.
He left the dressing room, hung the pair of slacks back up on the rack, and left the Fuga department store.
That did not take very long, he thought as he moved along the busy downtown sidewalk with the other pedestrians. Can he actually get the information by then? Contact Berlin? Relay my questions? Do all the coding and decoding? Every step involved? Apparently so. Now I wish I had approached the agent sooner. I would have saved myself much worry and distress. And evidently no major risk was involved. It all appeared to go off smoothly. It took, in fact, only 5 or 6 minutes.
Mr. Baines wandered on, looking into store windows. He felt much better now. Presently, he found himself viewing display photos of honky-tonk cabarets, grimy, fly-specked, utterly white nudes whose breasts hung like half-inflated volleyballs. That sight amused him, and he loitered, people pushing past him on their various errands up and down Market Street. At least he had done something, at last.
What a relief!
Propped comfortably against the car door, Juliana read. Beside her, his elbow out the window, Joe drove with one hand lightly on the wheel, a cigarette stuck to his lower lip. He was a good driver, and they had covered a good deal of the distance from Canyon City already. The car radio played mushy beer garden folk music, an accordion band doing one of the countless polkas or schottisches. She had never been able to tell them one from another.
"Kitsch," Joe said when the music ended. "Listen, I know a lot about music. I'll tell you who a great conductor was. You probably don't remember him. Arturo Toscanini."
"No,"
she said, still reading.
"He was Italian, but the Nazis wouldn't let him conduct after the war because of his politics. He's dead now. I don't like that Foncarian, permanent conductor of the New York Philharmonic. We had to go to concerts by him. Our work dorm.
What I like, being a WOP, you can guess."
He glanced at her.
"You like that book?" he said.
"It's engrossing."
"I like Verdi and Puccini. All we get in New York is heavy German bombastic Wagner and Orff. And we have to go every week to one of those corny U.S. Nazi party dramatic spectacles at Madison Square Garden, with the flags and drums and trumpets and the flickering flame. History of the Gothic tribes, or other educational crap, chanted instead of spoken, so as to be called art. Did you ever see New York before the war?"
"Yes,"
she said, trying to read.
"Didn't they have swell theater in those days?"
"That's what I heard.
Now it's the same as the movie industry. It's all a cartel in Berlin." In the 13 years I've been in New York, not one good new musical or play ever opened. Only those...
Let me read, Juliana said.
And the same with the book business, Joe said, unperturbed. It's all a cartel operating out of Munich. All they do in New York is print. Just big printing presses. But before the war, New York was the center of the world's publishing industry. Or so they say.
Putting her fingers in her ears, she concentrated on the page open in her lap, shutting his voice out. She had arrived at a section in The Grasshopper which described the fabulous television, and it enthralled her. Especially the part about the inexpensive little sets for backward people in Africa and Asia. Only Yankee know-how and the mass production system, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, the magic names, could have done the trick, sent that ceaseless and almost witlessly noble flood of cheap $1, the China dollar, the trade dollar, television kits to every village and backwater of the Orient. And when the kit had been assembled by some gaunt, feverish-minded youth in the village, starved for a chance, for that which the generous Americans held out to him, that tinny little instrument with its built-in power supply no larger than a marble began to receive. And what did it receive? Crouching before the screen, the youths of the village, and often the elders as well, saw words, instructions. How to read, first. Then the rest. How to dig a deeper well, plow a deeper furrow, how to purify their water, heal their sick. Overhead, the American artificial moon wheeled, distributing the signal, carrying it everywhere, to all the waiting, avid masses of the East.
"Are you reading straight through?" Joe asked. "Or skipping around in it?"
She said, "This is wonderful. He has us sending food and education to all the Asiatics. Millions of them."
"Welfare work on a worldwide scale," Joe said.
"Yes, the New Deal under Tugwell. They raise the level of the masses. Listen,"
she read aloud to Joe.
"What had China been? Yearning, one needful commingled entity looking toward the West, its great democratic president, Chiang Kai-shek, who had led the Chinese people through the years of war, now into the years of peace, into the decade of rebuilding. But for China, it was not a rebuilding, for that almost supernaturally vast flat land had never been built, lay still slumbering in the ancient dream. Arousing, yes, the entity, the giant, had to partake at last of full consciousness, had to waken into the modern world with its jet airplanes and atomic power, its autobahns and factories and medicines. And from whence would come the crack of thunder which would rouse the giant? Chiang had known that, even during the struggle to defeat Japan. It would come from the United States. And, by 1950, American technicians and engineers, teachers, doctors, agronomists, swarming like some new life form into each province, each..."
Interrupting, Joe said, "You know what he's done, don't you? He's taken the best about Nazism, the socialist part, the Taut organization, and the economic advances we got through Speer, and who's he giving the credit to? The New Deal. And he's left out the bad part, the SS part, the racial extermination and segregation. It's a utopia. You imagine if the Allies had won, the New Deal would have been able to revive the economy and make those socialist welfare improvements like he says? Hell no. He's talking about a form of state syndicalism, the corporate state, like we developed under the Duce. He's saying you would have had all the good and none of..." "Let me read," she said fiercely.
He shrugged, but he did cease babbling. She read on at once, but to herself. "And these markets, the countless millions of China, set the factories in Detroit and Chicago to humming. That vast mouth could never be filled. Those people could not in 100 years be given enough trucks or bricks or steel ingots or clothing or typewriters or canned peas or clocks or radios or nose drops. The American workman, by 1960, had the highest standard of living in the world, and all due to what they genteelly called the most favored nation clause in every commercial transaction with the East. The U.S. no longer occupied Japan, and she had